Feminist Federation, and whose details are in the programme. So I won't run through them, but over to you, Giulio. You're most welcome.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation. From what I heard in the first panel, I think that I can say that we are quite satisfied that the relationship between our organizations and the European Parliament also are improving. The start with the dialogue with the non-confessional group was a little bit timid at the beginning. It was quite different in some of the different periods. Nowadays, it seems to me it's on the right path, and thank you, Madam Vice President, for being instrumental also in this. And thank you also for choosing this topic for this session. We advocated that something like this would be discussed. We think it is an extremely important topic for our times, not only for the rest of the world, but also for Europe itself. The European Humanist Federation is the largest secularist organization in Europe. We have 65 member organizations across 20 of the European countries. I will focus on a probably unexpected regional perspective. This panel is about regional perspectives in the treatment of apostasy, that is the European one. In the last few years, the awareness of how serious the problem of freedom of thought and conscience has become in many countries for religious people has grown much keener and much more common. Especially the persecution of Christians and Jews in many countries where extreme Islamist fundamentalism and jihadism are rampant has been the focus of the interest of the media and of some political interventions. Rightfully so, of course, also in our opinion. But the same awareness is unfortunately often still missing with regard to the fate of the even more severe persecution of other groups of people that do not comply with the pretensions of extreme fundamentalists. That is, humanists, atheists, agnostics, rationalists, religious reformers too, and all those whose life stance is incompatible with extreme fundamentalist pretensions, beginning with feminists and LGBTI persons. They are all mostly amalgamated as apostates by the extreme fundamentalists. I didn't use the word non-believers because I was rather convinced by the remarks that were made by Madame Cresson at the beginning in the first panel. And I think that we should reevaluate possibly the label heretics, because also an atheist, after all, is defined with something that he has not. Well, the heretic, if I well remember, comes from ancient Greek hiereomai, which means to choose. So the heretics is the person that chooses. And we could include the heretics among our in this topic. It often happens that this is sometimes an even more severe persecution. It's not only my opinion, it is the opinion of the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion or Belief in his annual report of 2017. And that's for good reasons. The people of the book is sometimes recognized, even by some of the fundamentalists. To them, it's sometimes recognized the sort of protection that non-believers or heretics are, in the eyes of many of them, not entitled to. On paper, international and especially European human rights standards require that freedom of thought and conscience in the domain of religion be equally guaranteed to believers and to non-believers. In practice, if we consider the sort of attention reserved to non-believers, heretics, their fate is somehow considered a comparatively minor issue, or was, I could say, after the first panel this afternoon. But their sufferance is definitely not minor. Freedom of religion for believers, it is rightfully considered in our countries the historical origin and the cornerstone of individual freedom. But freedom from religion is often considered in some way a less sacred human right. This is quite obvious also in the behavior of our politicians and institutions in many of our countries, and sometimes even at the European level. But in the EU, Article 17 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union provides for equal respect and equal treatment for churches and religious associations or communities on the one hand, and philosophical and non-confessional organizations on the other. Would anybody here be surprised if I said that at state level and in many of our member countries, churches are usually treated with a much higher degree of reverence than our people? And even here, when we have to celebrate, for instance, the European cultural heritage, a sort of informal hierarchy of relevance and also of dignity is always very obvious, and many political leaders, not always the most populist, certainly not always the most extreme or the least influential, openly support this argument without restraint or reservations. That's probably why, with few exceptions, European politics largely ignores or underestimates the fate of the great number, impossible to evaluate, of foreigners that feel obliged to camouflage themselves in the great wave of migrations and flee from theocracies in search of freedom. Freedom also from political or social religious impositions. We often disregard these lovers of our model of constitutional liberal democracy. Yet we are the most secularized of the continents in the world today. And our democracy, including these very institutions, are at least as much the offspring of anti-traditional and anti-dogmatic thinking, of the Enlightenment, of rationalistic philosophy, of formalized legal and constitutional provisions, as they have mostly less direct roots in what is often called today the Judeo-Christian heritage. This is possibly better seen from outside than inside our union, and through the same media that so often are the vehicle for religious radicalization here in Europe. That's why, opposite to the populist narrative that only wants to see all immigrants as the worst enemies of our civic values and constitutional principles, within the large wave of immigration towards Europe, there are many would-be fellow citizens of ours that cherish those values and principles much more than populist electors and politicians, because they experimented what their absence means. I saw this firsthand last year when I took part in a debate in a conference hall of the Italian Chamber of Deputies to mark the 10th anniversary of the law that provides for humanitarian protection in Italy to LGBTI persons persecuted in their countries. And I saw this 5 years ago in Cairo when I took part in a conference organized by the European Liberal Forum and the Nauman Foundation with Arab liberals at coffee break. After participating in a panel on religion and politics, a lady behind me that I never met before introduced herself as an atheist. I was on the point of saying, nice to meet you, I'm Giulio Ercolesi, but she told me I was one of the very few persons with whom she could make her coming out as an atheist without a real risk that sooner or later the wrong and extremely dangerous persons would come to know. When they arrive among us, we never encourage these migrants to show up. On the contrary, they are, for many of our countries' political leaderships, a matter for embarrassment. In some countries, we even channel most of the welfare benefit directed to them through the organizations of the interreligious dialogue. Christian parishes working together with the often self-appointed and not rarely fundamentalist local imams. Some TV channels prefer to give voice in their talk shows to Muslim women wearing at least a scarf and discriminate those who wear more mainstream garments because they attract a smaller audience. And some self-styled progressive parties do the same when they look for immigrants with a Muslim background as candidates for elections. No wonder if most secularist migrants prefer staying silent. Giving them a say encouraging them to come out, to speak out, and to vindicate their choice is not only a political and ethical obligation for all those who believe in open societies and individual freedom. It could also help change the attitude of many of our fellow citizens and electors, at least the attitude of the many among them who fear migrations not because they have ethnic or racist prejudices, but because their lack of information leads them to see in all immigrants a risk for a renewed kind of obscurantism. Secularist migrants could also be a precious tool in the hands of mainstream politicians opposed to the populist threat. It is not only a moral mistake, but also a stupid political move not to entice them into taking part in our public debate. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Julia. I think there's some very important food for thought for those of us engaged in politics to take away there. And we move now to our next guest, who's Professor of Legal and Political Philosophy at the Université Libre de Bruxelles, Guy Hachette.